wishes from Nigerian novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's moving manifesto, We Should All Be Feminist, I was on a bus. The UU congregation that I served as community minister had chartered a bus to go down from Brooklyn, New York to Washington, D.C. for the inaugural Women's March on our nation's capital in January 2017. Ours was one in a lengthy caravan of buses, the majority of them filled predominantly by women and girls, headed south to protest the results of a presidential election that made it plain how powerful a force misogyny remains in this country. That day would mark the mobilization of the largest popular protest in American history. While the female candidate had won the popular vote, the male candidate had won the Electoral College, and our nation was painfully divided in the aftermath of that. American women, myself included, felt devastated and understandably so by the 2016 election. Gender, as it functions today, is a grave injustice we should all be angry, Adichie contends. Imagine how much happier we would be, how much freer to be our true individual selves if we didn't have the weight of gender expectations. Many women had begun to imagine just that as the US election results were getting tallied in November. They had envisioned a world where women had equal access at long last to the halls of power in this country. Then they had to reckon with a very different reality, our present reality, and the bitter disappointment that attended it. In her concession speech, Hillary Clinton told supporters, "This loss hurts, but please never stop believing that fighting for what's right is worth it. Now, I know we still have not shattered that highest and hardest glass ceiling, but someday, someone will. And hopefully sooner than we think right now." Supporters greeted that announcement with rounds of applause. And then she added, "To all little girls who are watching this, never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and deserving of every chance and opportunity in the world to pursue and achieve your own dreams." As we geared up for another presidential election in 2020, I thought of those little girls, because I too wanted them to believe that they were valuable and powerful and deserving, as valuable and powerful and deserving as any other American citizen. Last week, as Super Tuesday came and went, several states held their Democratic primaries, and one top female candidate and then another dropped out of the race, leaving two male frontrunners to vie for the party nomination. Interestingly, both of those women had split the editorial endorsement of the New York Times, which for the first time ever endorsed two candidates instead of one. On Wednesday, The Time published an opinion piece titled, "Maybe Next Time, Ladies." Perhaps you read it. Obviously, as more women run for elected office, more women than ever before will lose elections. That is the nature of politics. So we can always look ahead to next time, right, ladies? We can, yes. But recalling all those little girls, I question what they see when they watch all this play out on our national stage. More than 50% of the US population is female, and at nearly every level of government, women are significantly underrepresented. The US is ranked 75th among all countries worldwide in terms of representative gender government. These days, I think we all understand how much gender representation matters to people. Last Tuesday, beset by sadness, I recognized just how much it meant to me personally, and I suspect that I am not alone here in having an emotional response to recent election results. As Adichie observed, the higher you go, the fewer women there are, so in a literal way, men rule the world. And women dare not forget their place in it. Maintaining a vocal position on gender, Adichie explains that she considers feminism this most rudimentary advocacy for equality between the sexes, as a call for quote-unquote liberty and justice. She complains that women are taught to shrink in public spaces, to play small and stay small, to operate within narrow constraints, to inhabit the bounds of what society deems respectable, because otherwise, presumably, women would be deserving of absolutely no respect at all. We stifle women. We encourage them to trade their individual liberty for some measure of protection and discourage them from taking leadership positions. Worse, we publicly punish them for taking risks. Women are alternately parodied, silenced, maligned, erased, humiliated, or dismissed. Is it playing the so-called women's card to admit all this is true? If so, I have to say I can only play with the cards I'm dealt. Probably the greatest privilege of my admittedly privileged life was being sent to a girls' school in seventh grade when my parents overruled my objection to it, and graduating from it in the 12th, changed by the experience and frankly ruined for the rest of the world. In high school, I was selected to be part of a student delegation that would meet the then vice president as he passed through town on a political junket. We teenagers spent a lot of time waiting in the regional airport for a very brief meeting with him. And I was, as I recall, the only girl in the group. Before our brief time together ended that afternoon, the vice president of the United States said to me, "You're a sassy little thing, aren't you?" It wasn't a question, and it decidedly was not a compliment. Back at school, embarrassed by the encounter, I told the history teacher who had selected me the whole sordid story. I expected Mrs. Dixon to tell me to never mention it again. Instead, she was thrilled by this tale, and she made me its heroine. She was proud of me, and she wanted me to be proud of myself. Mrs. Dixon saw my repeated sassiness as a clear mark of distinction. After all, she suggested, the sassiest women make history. My teacher refused to stay silent about my experience, and she refused to have me shamed into silence. She recognized it for the simple sexism it was and taught me something important in the process. Gender is not an easy conversation to have, a teaching notes. It makes people uncomfortable, both men and women are resistant to talk about gender. But we have to address it directly with one another. That many men do not actively think about or notice gender is part of the problem, Adichie concludes. It allows gender bias to continue unchecked and unchallenged, and that has happened for far too long now. When white people say they do not see racism, people of color ask them to open their eyes. When men tell me they do not hear sexism, I ask them to listen more closely. Men need to listen not just for crude hate speech or gendered threats, they also need to listen for prolonged silences and things that never get said. They need to pay attention to women's stories when they are offered and to solicit them when they are not. They need to actively amplify women's voices instead of policing their tones. They need to become more attuned to double standards imposed on women and ask who's imposing them. Men need to join in uncomfortable conversations confronting gender injustice because our world needs women and it needs their leadership now more than ever. Today is International Women's Day, and there's a time for us to both honor the contributions that women have made and to imagine the contributions they will yet make in still more intentionally inclusive and egalitarian contexts. This afternoon, I'll be speaking with other female leaders at the inaugural townwide celebration of International Women's Day in Wellesley, and I invite all of you to come and join us at this landmark event. Hopefully, it will launch a feminist tradition in this community, and as Adichie insists, we should all be feminists now. In 2020, the United Nations announced that the theme for this International Women's Day is Generation Equality, Realizing Women's Rights. Earlier this month, UN Women issued a report that described the lagging progress toward gender equality worldwide and the hard-won historic gains that were coming under threat. While we can always anticipate backlash, we cannot become complacent about it. Gender matters everywhere in the world, Adichie observes. The good news is that a truly global feminism is emerging in stronger force. Adichie rightly notes that feminism is, of course, part of human rights in general. These days, women's rights are accurately portrayed as human rights. So UN Women calls on people everywhere to band together in confronting sexist behaviors, exposing discrimination, enlisting male allies, supporting female activists, challenging sexist stereotypes, sharing women's experiences, and advocating for gender parity across social, political, economic, and cultural domains. As people of faith committed to upholding progressive UU values, we must dedicate ourselves to these tasks at home and abroad. Because there is not a country presently on Earth that has achieved gender equality, UN Women mapped out an imaginary land they called Equaterra, that included such things as open access to education, freedom from interpersonal violence, and available reproductive health care. This is a place where every arbitrary barrier has been thrown down, much as writer Margaret Fuller hoped it would be nearly two centuries ago, where every path is at last laid open to women as freely as to men, a place where each woman can find the space she needs as a nature to grow, as an intelligence to discern, as a soul to live freely and unimpeded, to unfold such powers as were given to her, as Fuller envisioned, confident that a new manifestation is at hand, a new hour is come. Has that new hour come yet? When our bus from Brooklyn finally arrived in Washington that January day in 2017, I stepped off the bus as a collared protest chaplain and saw masses of people around the Capitol wearing bright pink hats they had made and carrying signs they had hand-lettered. They would spontaneously fall into formation, sing a song or two, then start new chants that everyone seemed to know by heart, and then move on. It was an inspiring sight in a profoundly dispiriting time. We had some marvelous men on our bus, and a couple of them asked me about a slogan they'd seen repeatedly at the Women's March, "The future is female." What did that mean exactly, they asked me. From my vantage, it did not mean, as they feared, that males had no place to play in the future. It meant simply that the past had never been female. That until recently, the patriarchy had told the tale of mankind in a partial and particular way. Clearly, the present was not terribly kind to females. But the time might be coming when women could figure as the indispensable players they are in the story of our common, shared humanity. They would get their overdue due. In 2017, we Unitarian Universalists marked another watershed moment. At long last, we elected the first female president of the UUA, the Reverend Susan Frederick Gray. Women had run for decades for that position and had lost for decades. Along the line, there had been some historic UU firsts, including our first black male president and our first Latino male president. Eventually, the UUA decided that it was time for another first, and so proposed an all-female slate of UU candidates. To this day, that bothers me. Imagine if the UUA had proposed an all-black slate, or an all-Latino one. What would have been the public response to that election? That an all-female slate, an all-female slate suggested that the race needed to be rigged in order for a woman to win. And honestly, it did. It did need to be rigged. But rigging that race without acknowledging how sexism influences outcomes represented the largest defeat. It felt patronizing because it was. Democracies involve contests, constant contests, but they are not games, and female candidates do not come to play. Like men, they come to win, and that is where the dynamic gets immediately and intensely problematic. It's hard to feel sporting when different rules apply. Women are always expected to be gracious losers, but men are not supposed to lose to women. They were not raised that way. The socialization is too powerful to deny, and women have not been raised to win. Can we name that fact? If women suddenly seem like sore losers, that feels like a mark of progress to me. We need new rules, people. We need a new day. We need a new hour, and we need it soon. Gender representation is not a partisan issue. If you think it is, please ask yourself what side of history you are standing on now. It is entirely legitimate to have an obvious concern for sexual equality. We need liberty and justice for all Americans who identify as female. The problem for me and other women looking all our lives to date, all our lives looking up through that glass ceiling, is that we have a crystal clear view of what we are denied. 100 years ago in 1920, women won the right to vote in elections in this country. After scores of years campaigning for it, strategizing around it, fighting for it, losing it, and fighting for it again. What suffragists had to sacrifice would astound us today. I sometimes wonder, how did they envision this country looking a century after women got the franchise? Like this? There is a national promise that is not yet fulfilled. There is an America that is not yet realized, and I, for one, have an intense curiosity about it. While we have more women in U.S. government than before, roughly a quarter now of our Congress, we have not nearly enough to represent the majority we are and have been in this country. In the poem called I Learned Her Name Was Proverb, poet Denise Levertov writes of time-worn promises that are drawing us toward the time and the unknown place where we shall know what it is to arrive. No doubt I speak for many women here when I say I want to know the time, the place, and the arrival. I want to arrive not in imaginary Equaterra, but in actual America. I'd like to have a woman president, our first and then our second, and so on. I am happy to be one of the feminists participating in the social movement, getting us there. So many of you have been participating in it too. But I have to say, I'm feeling a little impatient lately. Are you feeling impatient? I think a lot of us are feeling impatient lately. Maybe what we have to celebrate today is our impatience, our collective and pronounced impatience. Who says impatience isn't cause for celebration?